Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening, and thanks for coming. This is Little Atoms at Free Word. It's also the last event of the Shabbat Festival at Free Word. And I'm very pleased to welcome Tariq Shaheen. Tariq is an Egyptian cartoonist whose work's been published locally and internationally. He's also provided animated features for Al Jazeera English. He's the author of a daily comic strip, Al Khan, which ran for 2 years between 2008 and 2010. In Daily News Egypt, which is the Egyptian partner of the International Herald Tribune. That strip has now been compiled in this book, Rise, the story of the Egyptian revolution as written shortly before it began, which you were free to buy afterwards in the lobby. Tariq, thanks very much for coming. It's good. Worth every penny. Thanks for coming along, Tariq.
Thank you.
So let's just start with tell us where the idea came from, how you started writing Al Khan.
I had been writing over the last 10 years in various capacities, both as a blogger and with various contributions to various publications in Egypt, both in English and in Arabic, my native language. And towards the middle of the last decade, I spoke to the editor of the Daily News Egypt, which is the premier English language newspaper in Egypt. And I said, I have an idea for a daily comic strip that is discussing social, economic, and political life in Egypt through fictional stories. And the editor, and I have to mention her name, Rania Al-Malki, because she stands out in at that time and still today as a very, very courageous editor. At the time, she, amongst other restrictions, she said to me, you probably won't get more readers in our paper than you do on your various blogs. Why do you want to do this? And part of the response was, I said, because I want to rattle the cage of whoever is sitting on the other side censoring every attempt to write freely about all sorts of topics. And that's how it came about. The idea was to also differentiate from other cartoons that were editorial cartoons that were prevalent in Egyptian society at the time, because most people who wrote at the time were one of two things, predominantly very much pro-regime. They worked for state-run papers, which was just a nightmare to read. Or if they worked for an opposition paper or an independent paper, there wasn't a serialized comic strip that ran in panel form with constant characters that developed as a novel. And that's where the idea came from. This is a fictional story that was written with the events fused with real-time, real-life events as they played along, both locally and globally, which was in itself a different challenge altogether. But there was always, with every story line, a finish line as to how the story would end. Mm-hmm. And that's how it came about.
So it's kind of between character-driven and driven by news. As you can see, the strip here. So you said the other styles of cartoons were very much, you know, what we call editorial cartoons, which is day-to-day basis, kind of commenting on the news type thing. So this was quite a new thing in Egypt.
I imagine it was. I mean, I'm always very careful not to refer to anything I write as the first of its kind or anything, because there might have been something out there that was similar or probably better. But most people who read my stuff will acknowledge that. So yeah.
So tell us the story of Al Khan.
The story of Al Khan is a fictional story that ran for 2 years over three series that ends in the final few comic strips with the characters rising above their fears, rising above their differences and joining a peaceful revolution for change. The last trip ran in towards the middle of 2010. There are a few references that when people read today, I get a lot of people telling me you predicted the revolution exactly, but anything that seems like it was a prediction or foresight is nothing more than wishful thinking at the time. I wish I could take credit for forward vision, but I really can't, which just makes my happiness with what happened earlier this year in terms of the uprising very much more special. The interesting thing is, I'm quite possibly a liar in the title of the book, because I call it The Story of the Egyptian Revolution, as written shortly before it began, and I make very little reference in the comics that I wrote to the uprising that took place in Tahrir Square earlier this year. In fact, the stories, and as I call them, fictional stories that are compiled in the book, were about polygamy, spousal abuse, responsible journalism, sexual harassment, hymen reconstruction, football, arranged marriages, and religious dogma and religious intolerance. Maybe this was the revolution. Maybe the revolution wasn't the uprising against the 30-year rule of Hosni Mubarak, who we successfully toppled in February. I would go as far as to say that Hosni Mubarak is so vain, I bet he thinks this revolution was about him. When this uprising happened and I looked back at everything I wrote, I just realized that, or let me put it another way, when I was in Tahrir Square myself, joining this wonderfully peaceful uprising, it just came to me, that it dawned on me that the only reason this happened was that people finally decided to talk to each other and come together, and people were very afraid of the other person, even as we live together as 80 million people in the same country. Society, it was so... People thought they were so fragmented, whether, you know, you had the people who were conservative religiously, people who were conservative in terms of their economic views, people who were leftists, people who were very leftist, and Christians and their relationship with the majority Muslims and so on and so forth. That no one... It wasn't that we never thought that we could ever rise up against the police brutality in the way that we did, although that in itself seemed like an unsurmountable challenge, but it was the coming together. And interestingly enough, back to my cartoon, the whole, throughout the 2 years before the comic strip concluded, it was just characters who all felt immovable and unshakable in their conviction, every one of them thinking that their point of view about how to do things right and how to, you know, be a better journalist or be a better father was so right that they clashed together, and the clashes escalated, and then if you read the book, you'll see how eventually they just came together and became better versions of themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's how I related to the events.
Mm-hmm. What's very lovely about the strip is the way it does bring together so many different strands of Egyptian society through generally very likable characters, actually, even if, you know, they're kind of drawn from different kind of Muslim Brotherhood kind of angle, or from kind of very kind of Marxist kind of revolutionary angle. So do you want to tell people about the characters and who they represent?
Yeah. Before I tell about the characters, as a starting point, it's important to mention why I wrote it in English. I felt a responsibility to put a human face on to the rest of the world, on people that generally, and I'm not accusing the West in particular, but anyone who lives anywhere in the world just generally feels a disassociation from the other and tends to group them into one. And I just wanted to share stories that were funny. In many cases, I made light of very, very serious and sad situations, but I felt that was important. And for a global audience to relate to characters who you simply, when you're reading any news article, well, until recently, any news article on Egypt or the Arab world or Africa, you would have read very strange opening lines in any story. Egyptians believe this. Egyptians tend to do that. Middle Easterns, Easterners tend to eat this or drink that. No, they don't. I have any number of friends who do very different things, and I needed to bring that to life. So that's, and a very recent example of this, incidentally, was a news article, a number of news articles that came out just yesterday. David Cameron leaves Africa to address the firestorm relating to the news of the world. He didn't leave Africa, he left Nigeria. There are 50 countries in Africa. And so, I mean, that kind of story was the reason, part of the reason why I decided to write it so that it reaches a global audience. To your question, the characters who were very consistent throughout the strip were Omar, who is a former banker in London who decides to go back to his native Cairo to attend to the ailing newspaper of his ailing grandfather. So he felt the family needed him to take care of the family business. He's never been a journalist. He's now the publisher, and by publisher I mean capital. And he's faced with the editor, Neda, who is a card-carrying leftist. And the first major news story in which they have to clash is the, which I call here part one, the story of the privatization of a state-owned company. And so that's Omar. His little brother is Maggid, who is just all over the place, typical teen apathy, drug abuse, all sorts of issues that Omar needs to deal with while, when he's not trying to enforce his, interfere with the editorial content of the magazine. And by the way, the magazine is called Al-Khan, which is where the name comes from. Neda, I always wanted to make sure that every character had something that made characters think about where they came from in terms of their views. So the character of Neda, for example, is leftist, very much so, always at odds with Omar. But then we later discover that she is the daughter of a very, very wealthy actress who had made her fortune by making very trashy movies towards the end of her career as she got older. And so she's living actually a very comfortable life, and we wonder why and how she developed this passion for workers' rights and equal distribution of wealth and so on and so forth. For reasons Omar can't recall, he's also best friends with Anwar, a doctor who they always share a shisha together at the local cafe. And Anwar is a general practitioner doctor, and in Egypt that means you're poor. And there's a whole comic strip to address that whole issue. He is married to Aisha, who is on the cover here, who wears the niqab. And because she wears the niqab, even though I disagree with Anwar's views, in order to respect his wishes, I also never showed her face, even during the domestic scenes, as you'll see later in one of the strips. So throughout the entire strip, her face has been pixelated. Again, I do not endorse his way, the way he runs his household, but it's his household. A veteran photographer of Al-Khan is Yunan. He's past the age of 40, never married. His parents wish he wouldn't be a photographer, that he'd have a real job, such as being a pharmaceutical or a cashier at his father's pharmacy, anything other than this nonsense. And he is the subject of a storyline involving arranged marriages. And again, this is also the way I approach things was, typically when you read anything related to arranged marriages, the victim is always a young lady whose parents want to marry off to
A young Muslim lady.
I made it so that the audience were having the same reaction, feeling sorry for the person whose parents want to marry off, but in this case, a grown man. And so that's Yunan, and the way he deals with this and rises against this you'll see play out in the comic strip. And then there's, yeah, that's Aisha right there on the screen, her face pixelated, as I said. Big Falafel is a, as it seems, he's a street beggar, and he is the, he's a lot more than he seems. He is, amongst many things, the source to many of Neda's stories, because she's, as I said, is a top journalist. And these are the main characters. Throughout the series, they obviously interact with many other characters, and as you rightly mentioned, in the third series, Omar, obviously very secular and very, very much afraid of Muslim rule, Islamic rule in Egypt, forms a weird bond with a young member of the Muslim Brotherhood, for reasons that are explained in the comic strip, and so many other, and there are other characters such as a leftist member of parliament, which Neda forms a relationship with, it starts as a love relationship, and then for many reasons ends up being, she ends up presenting that personality and questioning her own views, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And there are many others, but I don't think I can go through all of them. But
it's pretty, I mean, I particularly liked Anwar, I thought he was just such a complex, interesting character. Because again, reading it in English and reading it from a Western perspective,
you couldn't hate him despite him being such a. That is the. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you, I think that's where you're going. The whole idea was that someone like Anwar, who really unapologetically treats his wife as a second class citizen, gives her orders, makes her aware of this or that, and his views are also, and of course I didn't mention Brother Levi, which is another issue altogether, but his Jewish friends, who is also only his friend because Anwar doesn't know he's Jewish, everything he says makes you just want to really snap at him and say, how could you be so intolerant, and how can you be this way? And yet on many other instances he's a kind-hearted person. Which begs the question, is he the way he is just because of ignorance? Is there hope for him? And the question as to whether there's hope for him is also answered towards the very end. That's Anwar.
So we've got, just bring back a bit from the characters to the context, I suppose. There are some brilliant references in the strip itself to self-censorship. There's one marvellous one where the character is worried that the editor is going to cut them out. But you yourself writing, we should make clear that you were writing in Egypt, in English albeit, but still in Egypt for an Egyptian audience at the time. Did you yourself ever feel any kind of outward censorship or inward censorship?
It was very difficult. I mean, some people had it much worse than I did, but some people, broadly speaking, just to describe the environment of fear that prevailed until very recently, some people made it their business to write blogs that were, a direct insult or attacks on the regime and calling for this and that, and these were very admirable.
To people such as Karim Mer, Sand Monkey.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And then you had this kind of writing, which was decidedly a form of entertainment, first and foremost, but which also made a point of being free and against the establishment. In general, the problem wasn't just that you always, you get a phone call from what I imagine is someone at the security forces just breathing heavily in the phone, or attending a meeting of bloggers, and he's an informant, and you can smell it. This whole environment is one thing, but the other problem was that until very recently, and I'll keep saying until very recently quite a bit in throughout this session, because it really was, everything I'm describing was as I'm describing it until January. Yeah. When you wrote the kind of thing I wrote, I didn't just fear the state. It was also that you were treated as a leper by the greater society. Why are you trying to rattle the cage? Why can't you just go to your job and come home and watch football? Why are you writing about politics? Just writing about politics or religion or anything was seen as such a... Why are you doing this? And that in itself made that our little group of people who wrote in various forms come together. And many times we used to ask each other, are we going to be in trouble? And every time I flew in and out of Cairo airport, I always said, today is the day they're going to confiscate my laptop or something, because I knew that a week before I'd written something that maybe, you know, that was against a direct reference to the regime. But the other fear, and which unfortunately may still be the case, is you have many regimes in the world where it isn't a very free society, it isn't a very democratic society, but at least you can write about sex and religion and all that wonderful stuff. Imagine being in a country where not only do you have to worry about the regimes, but also, you know, you're in a country where, or in a region where, until very recently, there still is a death fatwa on a cartoonist who drew, cartoons of the Prophet and all that sort of thing. So, in general, you always worry that it's probably safer for you to just not write anything. So it's not easy, but I thought it had to be done. I just thought we needed to, if we have something to say, we have to say it.
Can you think of like the specific instance where your pen was hovering over the page and you hesitated?
No, I don't. My biggest issue was when they ran, the scariest phone call I used to get was from my parents. My father would just say, why? Why? I can't chase lawyers and stuff. Can we just wait? Yeah, I mean that is, and of course, some of the comments you'd see either on the online page of the newspaper or on Twitter or any of that, some of them would be borderline threats, and unfortunately, those were the ones that were where you challenged a social taboo more than just challenged the police state. These were this equally scary and sad. I mean, you just want people to, but I always had confidence that even though there was the few who would read it and just understand it to be offensive and they'd say something threatening, but I always knew that at least today I've changed at least one person's mind. And that I never knew for sure. Although I knew, I won't give away that part of the story, but when a certain character died, the reaction to me said that some people you'd expect a certain kind of reaction, and the reaction seemed to imply to me that people had become more open-minded. Mm-hmm. People who you wouldn't think would react to the death in the way that they did. I'm sorry, I'm being very vague, but just for your.
You will have to read the book. And there's a very strong sense, in particularly when the characters address politics or religion, of living with, what else is there? Football possibly is the other strand. But there's a one set of people living with the absurd and the contradictions of their society, which reminded me of, there's a fantastic book called Hammer and Tickle about jokes in the Soviet Union.
Okay.
Is that a very prevalent kind of sense, your kind of way of expressing yourself in Egypt, or was, I mean, we still don't know where we're headed in Egypt, but under the Mubarak regime, was that kind of grasp of the absurdity of the situation clear in society?
If I understand your question clearly, are you saying that people sometimes just vented their frustration into the most trivial things? Because you mentioned,
well, there is that, but there's also, you know, one of the things when you address, say, NDP kind of economic policies, which at times make no sense to anybody.
Yeah,
and everyone knows they make no sense, but you just kind of accept this is the situation. Is that something you feel very strongly in Egyptian society as a whole? Is that the kind of humor on the street?
No, absolutely. As I mentioned, I make a very strong point about this. There is a reason that there are very relatively few direct mentions of sort of anti-regime or direct references to the state, the police state that we were living in. And many of the other absurdities, thank you for using that word, because yes, these absurdities came from a place of, there was a certain constant, and that constant was the cage we were living in. And the cage we were living in meant that as long as we're living in this cage, let's just fight about football. Let's just fight about, let's get very angry about social taboos and of any nature. And I made a comment about a lot of these things, and in many cases I confronted the reader with the, for example, the over obsession with football. And interestingly enough, there's it's not on the screen, but there's one in particular where I was telling the audience that they need to be more like Iran. This is back in 2009 because the Iranians had started this green revolution, and they were saying, "Where is my vote?" And the Americans were saying, "Where is my dream?" And the Europeans were saying, "Where are my rights?" And then the Egyptians were holding a placard saying, "Where is my replay? Brazil should not have Brazil should not have scored that goal." And there are many references to that. I hope I've answered your question, absolutely.
Yeah. Yes, there is one, again, trying not to give too much, right? There is one brilliant punchline where they're talking about football, and as much as praying.
Yeah,
and he's looking up to heaven and saying, "If we don't beat Algeria, all we have left is prayer."
So please, God. That actually never makes. I always feel very sad when I read that one. I mean, it's hilarious to anyone else. Except for some reason, every time I read it, I try to find. It is quite sad because, as Patrick said, I mean, at the end of it, you know, if we don't win this game, we will lose hope in our government, in our country, in our freedom, and all we will have is prayer. So please, God, let us win this game.
It reminded me, actually, I'd like to talk about myself for a moment. I was living in an Algerian part of London at the moment. At the time of the Algeria-Egypt games, it was World Cup qualifiers. And it was the same night that France played Ireland, and I was getting a bus up to an Irish pub to watch the Irish game. And the Egypt-Algeria game finished just beforehand. And the bus suddenly screeched to a halt as hundreds of Algerian men poured out of cafes on the seven sides of the road. And they all came out and they're cheering and chanting. And everyone stopped for a second and thought, and you could see everyone thinking at the same time, "What do we do now?" And spontaneously, about 200 young Algerian blokes just got down in the middle of the street and started praying.
No, there was absolutely that kind of helplessness. And as I said, no one was even discussing politics. Mm-hmm. People were so complacent, not complacent, but there was no hope. The police state was too powerful. There is no way we can achieve many things. We can start a business and maybe make it successful. We can maybe find the girl of our dreams. We can maybe win a football match. Hold on, you mean shape our future? No, we're not going to do that. But I mean, We are doing that now. Regardless of where it ends up, I mean, that is absolutely undeniably what's going on right now in Cairo. Mm-hmm. We are shaping our future.
Mm-hmm.
In Egypt, I mean, yeah. I'm sorry to say Cairo. It's obviously across the nation.
Happening in other places too. You say that you're wary of being seen as prophesying anything happening. But equally, I think there is a perception maybe in kind of news outlets and just generally here that the whole Arab Spring started with one guy setting himself on fire in Sidi Bouzid, and then everyone just went, "Oh, hang on, let's have democracy now." But there's a lovely example in the book. It's from 27th January 2010, where Nada is talking about police state, which had been made a holiday the year before.
Exactly a year before the uprising.
It made a holiday in 2009. It was made. That was 25th of January 2010. The 25th of January is Police Day, and they that was declared by Mubarak in 2009 to celebrate the Egyptian police. Well, originally Police Day was a day defined by the Egyptian police against the British, I think. But it was created as a celebration of the wonderful work that the police did for Egypt. And this was at a time when, you know, the news was full of stories of brutal torture by the police on bloggers and dissenters of various kinds. There's a wonderful strip from Police Day 2010 where Nada finishes off with Nada looking befuddled and saying, "I need a holiday, when's the next Police Day?" And of course, what happened on the next Police Day, no one could possibly have predicted.
Well, I mean, just in the panel before, she says, in this comic strip, which is exactly to the day a year before the uprising on Police Day in 2011, one of her staff members says, "Why didn't you give us a holiday? The whole nation, the president declared it a national holiday and said, what are we celebrating? We're celebrating police thuggery and the police state, and this whole country is run by thugs, and they only protect the regime and not the people. And then her staff member says, are you all right? Do you need to sit down? And she says, and as you said, I need a break. When is the next police day? So, that one, to be honest, I mean, I gave this, I have to qualify. I would very much like to say that this was foresight, but it's just fun to read now, but it's just one that I'm happy to have in the book.
But the broader point, these conversations had been happening in Egypt. People, you know, there had been the strikes in 08.
Yeah.
And social movements had been emerging. Particularly, say, you know, there had been, maybe we're more familiar with here, with the bloggers, such as, again, Sand Monkey, Karim Amer, who was imprisoned, and others. So this didn't just happen in a vacuum. This conversation was going on at some level.
Absolutely, yeah. I want to say 10 years, but it's really from in the 5 years prior, you started having this blogosphere develop, and many people starting to write in a blog. It was a little bit before, sometime before Twitter, and the more politicized use of Facebook that we're seeing now. But yes, people started talking, people started pushing the envelope in various ways and various forms. And I'm talking particularly about writers, but many of those writers happen to be also activists who contributed personally to the strikes in Mahalla, again, a textile factory, and all of that. So you're absolutely right. It didn't. The events in Tunisia emboldened everyone to say, "Hold on." The events in Tunisia told people that an Arab leader will be toppled, which is very helpful. But in Egypt, in particular, you did have, and back to, I wouldn't have been able to write any of this, even though they were fictional stories. But the backdrop was a backdrop of rising awareness, rising activism, and the desire of people who were more who cared and were had some intellect to do something, whether it's to do something in their own households, you know, rise against your parents if they want to force you into an arranged marriage, divorce your husband if you've just had enough. And that kind of thing, but also in political terms. In fact, you give a reference to the textile workers rising in 2008, and 2008 is the timing of the first series, and there must have been a subconscious reason for me to have made the central story of the first series, which ran to the end of 2008, about the workers objecting to the privatization of a state-owned company, factory.
So you were in Tahrir Square and in Cairo in the spring. Was there perhaps a change in the sense of humor among people?
I discovered that most people are much funnier than I am. Absolutely. Where were these people? I never... And that actually speaks to the fact that no one spoke at all. If the signs and... I mean, the reason, you know, people know my work is because, not because necessarily I'm the best writer, I'm surely not, but it's because no one did put their views out there. And suddenly you have this explosion of creative juices are flowing since the revolution and, more importantly, during. The signs that people held, I mean, I don't know if this is funny in English, it was very funny in Arabic, but at one point the regime was trying to tell people at home that actually this wasn't the people rising against the president. It was actually a foreign conspiracy funded by the European Union. And proof of that was that many people in Tahrir Square were given KFC sandwiches, Kentucky Fried Chicken sandwiches, with 50 euros slipped hidden under them. And obviously I saw this... online or on television at the time, and the next day I was in the square, and a guy who just is the most, probably comes from the simplest of backgrounds, made his way there and held a little cardboard placard that said, KFC is closed, you idiot. Which is, and I'm happy to show it to members of the audience later. I have it on my, and because obviously in the square, because of the events, none of the restaurants were open. They were all smashed to smithereens. I mean, what KFC sandwiches were given out? This is just one example that I could remember. It was very, very inspiring. So I take a huge pride in the kind of humor that I write and the storytelling that I write. I would never come up with anything half as funny as that. I'm the first to admit. Absolutely. It was, so to your point, I totally agree.
Mm-hmm. One of the quite brilliant, quite interesting strands of the story is the story of Dr. Ibal. Who is an American-Egyptian sociologist?
Anthropologist.
Who has pretty much kind of, you know, it made a career selling, you know, ideas of the Muslim world and the Middle East to Westerners. But what it brings up is a very keen idea of the idea of how Egyptians see themselves as being perceived and how important that is. So do you maybe talk a little bit about that?
No, the character of Dr. Ibet, who just descends on Egypt to try to study Egyptian and Arab culture, and obviously clashes with Neda for reasons that become obvious in the strip. She was just merely another way for me to insult my readers, which I really enjoyed doing. It's always difficult for me to insult my readers because at the same time, I want them to love me. But she was symbolized the very idea that when you read her storyline, and I actually have her in the very first page of the book, which is an epilogue I wrote after the events. Very much so. She is how a caricature of how people abroad, in this case in the West, although I stress that my issue isn't with the West, it's just with the other, and how the other is perceived globally. And her ignorance and her cluelessness about, and at the same time her confidence that she is the ultimate authority on Arab culture and the Egyptian household and polygamy and all of that sort of thing, is she's so immovable. It's just one of the final things I did in the strip was just to tell people, you just can't get it right. And this wasn't just Dr. Ibet. I mean, I made a point of giving an individual trait to every character, including the terrorist, which I have at towards the end as well. And I didn't make him human, because he, in the character, you have one fundamentalist character who ends up committing murder out of pure hatred. And I didn't want to make him human, but what I wanted to do was to make sure that the person he killed, he is the kind of person that the world would expect him to kill for the reasons that the world would expect him to kill. But the hilarity comes from the fact that he was meant to kill someone entirely different for an entirely different reason. And that, to me, is even the terrorist in the strip, I needed to differentiate from what is considered a stereotype. I didn't justify what he did. I didn't have him maybe battle with... he was a murderer, no question. But he was not the murderer that people expected him to be. Mm-hmm.
So, just finally, well, getting near the end of the conversation, we'll open up to the floor. Then. Is this an art form that you think is going to take on in Egypt now?
I really hope so. Egypt, currently and historically, has great artists. And mind you, obviously not just in cartoon form. I mean, I surely was influenced by many Egyptian satirists. Names you wouldn't recognize, but Yusuf Auf, who you've never heard of, Naguib al-Rehani, who you've never heard of, Hassan Abdul Quddus, who isn't a satirist, but a novelist who's just, who you've never heard of. And the reason is because they've never been translated. Why? Because others have, because they're maybe easier to read. Where was I going with this? Sorry.
No idea.
No, yeah, but back to there is, as I said, since the uprising and a little bit before that, the creative juices in society in general have been flowing like they've never flowed before. I've just been made aware of a number of graphic novel or comic book publishing houses that have just popped up, many of them publishing their first titles very soon. And I haven't read them, but I really hope. Because here's the thing, I really enjoy reading comic books as mm-hmm. well as writing them. As it happened, as I said, during the time that I wrote this, I'm sad to say that, as far as I'm concerned, cartoonists were either irrelevant because they were just parrots of the regime, or the opposition ones were great, they had their audiences. They didn't necessarily, in my opinion, encourage critical thinking or develop characters. I hope that so in this kind of format, I think up to now still is associated very much with myself because I haven't read many like it. I really hope that changes. I hope I'm one of many dozens in the future. I really do.
So, are there any questions from the forum?
You said earlier that you wrote in English because you wanted to speak to a Western audience.
A global audience.
Yasmin El-Rashidi sat in that same chair last week, and she's written primarily about the uprisings in the New York Review of books, and she said that since the Arab Spring, no one wanted to write in English anymore. Everyone wanted to write in Arabic because that was the audience that they wanted to speak to. So I wondered, since the events of this spring, do you think you'll write more in Arabic, and has your audience focus shifted?
The cartoons I've written since the uprising have been in Arabic. I've never put it into context before. Maybe if Yasmin were here, maybe she'll explain why I've been driven to do that. But my response is that there is a sense that there was, and this is a terrible thing to say, but there was a sense of people like all of us who wrote, and many of us wrote in English, felt that, well, what's the point of writing in the native language? 40% of the population is illiterate. The others are just ignorant and hopeless, incorrigible. And now, because the events have surprised us and we've discovered that we can talk to each other, the next guy is just as smart as you, even if he has completely different views about the politics or any other subject. And yeah, we should probably talk to each other some more. I think that it's part of the subconscious reason why I've since been writing in Arabic. I personally, speaking for me, I plan to write in both languages, but I absolutely feel a lot more encouraged to write to a local audience. And mind you, it's not just writing to a local audience. It's because everything that I have said about the rest of the world really just painting everyone in a certain region with one brush, that's already changed because of the uprising. I feel that in that regard, my work is done. I in a year's time, I can never sit here and say, oh, by the way, I'm writing in English because you all have stereotypical views of Egypt. That's part of the accomplishments of the uprising. It wasn't the intention of the uprising, but certainly one of the results. And perhaps I feel I don't need to do that anymore. You know, maybe someone will translate my work, but I'm happy to write in a local language.
How did you evade capture so long? Was writing in English part of it?
No, I don't believe so. I mean, the way that what scared the regime and the powers that be at the time were two things I imagine equally. If you wrote in Arabic, then their fear was that you would incite or encourage people to dissent. If you wrote in English, then you may influence a congressperson or senator who then decides to block aid to Egypt until they democratize. So the censors were equally, I imagine, wary of both languages. But how, I think my writing was above their level of understanding. I think it's a combination of subtlety and maybe they just really didn't pay it. They went through the first two panels and just didn't bother to go to the other. I really don't know, but it's not to say that I wasn't noticed. I mean, I have many reasons to believe that they were. I mean, like many others, they were quite aware and monitoring very carefully. I joke about them not reading the whole strip. They were very thorough. They read everything. maybe they had more important people to arrest. I intentionally didn't mention any sort of non-entertainment work or any sort of activist stuff, but one of the things that, one of the cartoons I've never ever taken credit for, out because it was part of a campaign, was a logo for a t-shirt that actually I think that image made Time magazine at the time, and I never took credit for it, was to free a friend of ours who was captured for being in a demonstration in 2005, something unheard of back then because it was a few people who were doing it. And at the time, when we went to visit him when he was released, everyone contributed to the campaign to release him. But obviously, we knew, you know, walking in and out of his building, but just the army of people pretending to be bystanders, who we all knew were police, and obviously taking down our car, the license plate number and all that. So I don't know if I've answered your question. So they were quite aware and quite weary and hope maybe trigger happy in terms of their willingness to arrest and put a stop to any kind of writing. Maybe I was lucky, or maybe it was just the subtle way in which I wrote. So.
If you continue to write Al Khan during the uprising earlier this year, how would you have portrayed that? I mean, would you have been a bit more delicate, or would you sort of really have drawn on that and put that into Al Khan and used your character strongly to be an uprising?
I think I was strong enough before these events. I don't know how to answer that. Part of it because no one had the time to. I certainly wouldn't have physically been able to write as articulate. By the way, I did write two cartoons during the uprising. They weren't in panel form, but they were very much directed at the regime. Let me put it this way. I think I've been invited by some writers and some publishers to basically write, be one of what a writer for what I'm sure over the next year or more will be several graphic novels about the uprising in Tahrir. I'm actually very cautious not to do that because I feel when it's written with 2020 hindsight, it's going to be, I don't know if triumphant is an actual word, is it?
Triumphalist,
exactly, yes, thank you. I'm from the Middle East, I'm not actually English, but triumphalist is the word, and they will be the kind of thing that is more celebratory than critical. And at the same time, I have very little to criticize in terms of what happened, because it was perfect. It was, I think history will remember this as a perfect uprising, from the people's point, from the side of the people, in terms of just how peaceful and how organized and how beautiful it was. I don't know if I ever want to write a depiction of the uprising, because maybe I won't do it justice. My style of thinking is to just move on and look at what are the new issues and be critical of them, as I've done in the cartoons. I mentioned I've written in Arabic, and most of these have been directed at the what's known as the party of the couch, the people who aren't still in revolutionary mode and are just sitting on their couch and criticizing anyone who continues to call for extra rights. I don't know if I've answered your question, but I did at the time. They depicted the events and they criticized the regime, and that's what I did towards that. I may not write any more about the actual uprising.
Of the panels that I've seen, they were barbed and political and funny and...
Thank you.
I really like them. There's one in particular where I thought you were standing really close to the wind, and that was the one about rape. And I just wondered, how close to the wind did you feel that you could sail with some of the issues that you were discussing? Because the whole thing about virginity and arranged marriage and the whole kind of like Muslim-Jewish thing, I get that completely, but the rape one kind of surprised me, but didn't really shock me. But I found myself laughing in spite of the taboo nature of the subject, so I just wondered, how far did you really feel that you could go?
This was a personal decision.
Because that would really appear in an English comic. I can't imagine seeing that in a comic strip.
I think maybe if you can just roll back and explain the context of the particular strips about sexual assault and rape.
Yes, I think you're referring, just for the purpose of the audio, you're referring to one in which Anwar is over a shisha, is describing to Omar why his fellow gynecologists are making a lot of money and conducting hymen reconstructions, and then Omar asks, why? Is it because people are finding that love is a greater virtue than marriage? Than virginity, I'm sorry. And then Anwar says, no, it's nothing terrible like that. It's because rape is on the rise. Throughout my comic strips, I've made the decision to be funny about these very hurtful issues. Despite many of my female friends sometimes taking offense, I just really felt this was the way to address them. Because it's very, I mean, I'm very supportive of any organization that doesn't obviously use humor, but just uses awareness and raises charities for all sorts of issues like that. But I really wanted to address them with humor. Why, I can't know at the time. If it's any consolation, it worked. It got a lot of my readers talking about these issues. It raised a lot of debate. A lot of people are still uneasy about some of the words I've used and some of the scenes, and there are many that are a lot worse than the one you saw on the screen there. But I guess in the back of my mind, I felt that making light of it will create a debate even amongst intelligent people, because it's easy for you to write something, and I applied this throughout all the strips, not just the ones about these kinds of issues. It's easy for you to say, oh, I'm going to write something that intellectuals will love it, but only the idiots, the ignorant people are going to take offense, and, you know, fuck them, who cares? But to actually get people who are all equally intelligent debating as to whether I should have said this, or whether the character should have said this, is, I thought, created a very fruitful debate at the time. And I hope to continue doing that, because that's certainly something that continues to be and will continue to be an issue.
Just following up on that, the whole, you know, kind of narrative that exists, I'm not giving too much away, where Nada's sister is assaulted, is, you know, it's incredibly sensitive, actually, about what must have been, and is certainly portrayed as a very, very difficult subject. And Nada's attempts to get people to speak out about that subject are really, really brilliantly done.
Thank you. Is that a question or just...
No, I'm just saying. Okay.
I agree.
I'm just setting your book, Tara. Is anyone else have another question? I think we're done. Thank you very much, Tariq Shaheen. I'm sure you'll join me in giving a good round of applause.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.